Hi, everybody. Welcome to the K9 Academy podcast. We have a very exciting guest here today. This is Christina from Hairy Tail. She's actually very close to us, and I've wanted to have her on this podcast for a while. We just haven't had the opportunity. We've both been busy. So, Christina, can you quickly introduce yourself?
Yeah. So I'm Christina, of course. I run Hairy Tails, which is Midtown Toronto. It's Mount Pleasant at Eglinton. I primarily do private classes, and I primarily work with people who have dogs who are having behavior issues. I do puppy stuff. I do basic obedience, but honestly, my specialty is behavior issues. And I have started doing some workshops and some group classes again, primarily for behavior issues and reactivity.
Perfect. So if someone were to contact you, mm-hmm. right, and they said, oh, I have a dog, I have a situation, what would be the primary, service that they would do?
So with me, usually it's private unless they want to do group, but most of it's private. And honestly, most of my clients will do anywhere from 3 to 5 sessions over a period of 4 to 6 months, depending on the severity of the behavior. And of course their ability to do the homework in between sessions. So I don't actually see them often. It's like, here's your homework. I'm going to be support for you between sessions, but you need to do the work. Otherwise, I'm not going to train your dog for you. That's just good. Not how I work.
Yeah, good. Good, good. And tell us about yourself. When did you get started? How did you get started?
It's a bit of a long story, but I'll try to shorten it. So growing up, I wanted a dog forever. Like it's always, but my parents didn't want to get me one. Finally, on my 12th birthday, they caved. And I got this poodle, purebred, from a breeder. They thought they were doing the right thing to go buy this purebred dog who had, you know, CKC certification. That was a disaster. So he was 4 months old when he came home, which we both know now is a bad idea. He lived outside of Toronto, so no socialization at all. When he got home, it was already obvious that he had allergies, like skin allergies, which progressed to get super, super bad to the point where he was ripping his hair out of his body and bleeding all over.
Oh my goodness.
And then on top of that, probably half because of the being uncomfortable and itching all the time, he became pretty aggressive with my brother and I and anyone else who came into the house. So he was 20 pounds. Like he's not a big dog, but he has a good bite. Like I have scars on my face from this dog. Like I would go to pet him on the couch and we'd be chill. Like we'd be fine. And he's one of those dogs who would just like snap and just go. So I had to learn, because my parents obviously wanted to get rid of him. I mean, like any parent probably would if the dog is, you know, biting the children. And it was pretty kind of unprovoked in the sense that he didn't show very many signs before it happened. But I said that I would run away with the dog if they got rid of him, despite the fact that he was trying to bite my face. So they were like, well, we have to do something. So basically we enrolled in dog obedience. Actually, they still exist. North York Obedience. Have you heard of them? They're this old school obedience up in North York.
Okay.
It's very like no treats, just like a slip collar. They do like exams at the end of each level of obedience. Like, the basic, like the old school.
Yeah.
And then after the obedience class, I'd go and get extra help from those mostly older ladies. They were so funny. And they would kind of give me tips on what to do when my dog tried to attack me. That's where I learned an alpha roll.
Oh,
at 13.
Nice. I was going to ask, what were the tips?
That was one of the suggestions. Okay. And actually, not that I would suggest to many people in many circumstances to do an alpha roll, but it did work for that dog.
Can you explain what it is?
So an alpha roll is kind of a very old school. It's kind of like you're copying the quote unquote, you know, alpha dog in when a dog is. So basically it's the last thing that a dog will do to correct another dog when the dog isn't responding to the other minor behavior corrections. And so it's usually done after probably 4 or 5 chances of the dog saying, stop it, I don't like that, stop it, you know, whatever. And then they basically will grab the dog usually by the scruff and like pin it to the floor and hold it down until it stops fighting and calms down.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, at 13, I didn't weigh very much either. I was a small child. It was a lot.
Yeah. So, the alpha roll, I've heard many people do it. I remember I went to PetSmart once and there was a trainer at PetSmart. I was a kid when this happened and I saw him demonstrate an alpha roll on a young husky.
Oh my God.
And I remember he said, and I was sitting there watching, cause I was always interested in dogs, and he pinned the dog and he said, you need to make sure you make eye contact with the dog and then they start looking away. Is this the same information you got?
No, I was just told to like hold him down until he stopped fighting and like kind of calm down.
Got it.
So the eye contact wasn't a part of the information I received.
Good, good. Yeah, like I saw this at PetSmart.
That's intense. I'm actually surprised because now apparently they're all positive reinforcement only at PetSmart.
Super positive now.
That's really funny.
It makes no sense. They carry prongs in the aisles. So,
right.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Anyway.
Okay, and what kind of training did you do from there? So you did your classes.
So we were doing those obedience classes and he actually did, for the most part, like... The only thing that we knew, and that was kind of one of those kind of, I respect my dog that he doesn't like this thing, was like, you wouldn't go and touch him or grab him from the behind. That would be the only time he would turn. And even then he wouldn't bite you. He'd just go rah, rah, rah. And that
Got
was
it.
It. So he was way better. The allergies also took a while. We had to see a holistic vet for that, who Got I it. Saw for years later until recently when she stopped practicing. So that actually went fine. Then when I turned 21, I believe, I took a trip to Guatemala and found a bunch of puppies on the street.
Nice.
There were three of them, abandoned, umbilical cord still attached. They were in a hole. There was a huge rainstorm. They were freezing cold. This was a really sad situation. I dug them out of the hole with the help of my partner, tried to bring them home and nurse them, but within 24 hours, every single one of them died. Because I don't know if you know this, when puppies don't get mother's milk...
Yeah.
They don't produce the antibodies to survive whatever the germs are that are
How
going
old
on.
Do you think they were?
I don't know, like a couple of days probably.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, that's terrible.
So I was devastated.
Yeah.
And then when I went back to this language Spanish school that I was studying at without these three puppies in my arms, there was a cleaning lady there who was like, well, what happened? And then I like burst into tears and I was like, they died last night, you know, and she's like, oh, I'm really sorry. But I have eight puppies at my house that are like 4 weeks old. Do you want one? What do you think my response to that was? Yes. So after school, I walked to her place, literally mud thatched hut. She has five kids under the age of 6 years old.
Oh my goodness.
It's a street dog. Yeah. So it's a shepherd mix. You could already tell she was 50% shepherd just by looking at her. But the puppies, I think they had two fathers because a lot of them look cocker. There was a cocker, red cocker running in the mix with the pack of dogs that was in that area, who was an intact male. The other ones, I don't know. So Shella's father was definitely not the cocker, because when I did the DNA, there's no cocker. So Shella's the dog I picked up from Shella, Guatemala, at 4 weeks old, which is really, really young, but she was already malnourished. So I kind of had to make a decision, like either leave her for five more days with her family or... I don't know. I just felt concerned that she wasn't getting enough food. You could see her ribs.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Already at 4 weeks. Like, yeah, that's not great.
Yeah.
So I took her home with me, I raised her from 4 weeks. She was, like, an amazing dog, and unfortunately she passed 2 months ago.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was it was so heartbreaking to see.
Yeah.
That would have been your first dog that got you
personal,
into this.
Like, my own.
Yes.
Like, I raised her myself. Yeah.
Would you say she got you into the industry or your poodle?
No, it was... So it's a combination of the poodle
okay.
and Batuk, my Indian street dog.
Yes.
Who is still with us. He's 11. But he was a big disaster.
Got it. And how'd you get him?
Again, traveling. So I wasn't expecting to come home with a dog again. So I was working for Dharamsala Animal Rescue, which is a rescue up in Dharamsala, India, which is in the Himalayan foothills. It's really beautiful. It's where all the Tibetans live up yep. there. They cross the Himalayan mountain range from Tibet to escape, and they end up there. And that's where the Dalai Lama is, too. So I was there for 4 months, and in the last month of being there, I found... Batuk on the street, and he was probably anywhere from 6 to 9 months. It's hard to know because they're malnourished.
Yeah.
So their growth is stunted, like their baby teeth aren't forming or coming out at the right time. And he was like acting really funny. So I thought he was sick because he was shut down. Like most street dogs, when you are nice to them, especially puppies, they're like, ooh, are you going to feed me? Like they get excited. They'll wag their tail. You'll get kisses, whatever. He did not do that. His head was down. His tail was tucked. Like, he didn't acknowledge me at all. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird. So then I picked him up thinking, like, maybe he'll try to attack me, which he didn't. He literally just, like, froze. Like,
oh,
he did
no.
nothing. So then I was like, okay, there's something seriously wrong with this dog. So I took him, but it was already 4:30, so I couldn't get him to the clinic. So I'm going to have him in my apartment overnight. And the next morning I took him to the clinic. He still hadn't peed by the time I brought him to the clinic. So it had almost been 24 hours by that point. And the vet saw him and they were like, no, he's in perfect health. I'm like, so why hasn't he peed yet? And they're like, he's traumatized. And I was like, okay. So then I thought, he's a very good looking dog. He looks kind of like a Husky Shepherd.
Yeah, he's very cute.
He's coyote is what most people say. But anyways, up in India, street dogs are not a commodity that people are interested in having. But if the dog looks like a purebred, they would maybe be interested. So my idea of thinking was, if I bring him around town with me, that some locals might think that he's cute and he's a male. So that's also a thing. Male dogs in India are more preferable because they don't have puppies. That they would want him. So for a week, I'm parading this dog around with Shella in India because Shella came to India with us too.
Nice.
People wanted to pay for Shella, by the way, which is hilarious because she's a street dog from Guatemala. And so my partner would keep saying to them, literally, this is a street dog with a bath. Like, just, you know, take one, give it a bath and feed it, and it will look like her. So nobody wanted him, but he was perfect while we were in India, honestly. Perfect. We crated him in Shella's crate. Like, he was a very good boy.
Good.
But that's because he was traumatized.
Okay, and then you...
So then we get back to Toronto.
Yeah.
We'd had him for a month, just that 3 to 4 week period, right? And we get to Toronto, and he literally is just like, okay, so I'm comfortable enough to, like, deal with things that I don't like in the way that I feel like I need to. And basically, he didn't like anyone. So he was very reactive to 100% of people, 100% of dogs.
Oh, wow.
Did not matter. And I live at, like, Yonge and Eglinton. So I'm walking him. I pass a person or a dog every, like, 2.5 minutes. So it was very stressful. I actually also had PTSD when I came back from India because as a white woman, when you're there, there's a lot of men who think that it's appropriate to try to basically sexually harass you and touch you right in public. Like, jeez. You could be at a market in broad daylight and somebody will literally try to touch you inappropriately. So I was in, like, a defense mode because I had been like that for 4 months and I couldn't shake it off. So I also, now that I realize this, because it took me taking a self-defense class to get this out of my system, that I also, so I was probably also feeding into him, right? So he was sensing my, like, I'm going to have to, like, kick the shit out of somebody who tries to touch me. And he's scared. So, like, it was a very bad. So it was him who ultimately brought me to dog training.
Got it.
Because at the time, so this is 10 years ago. So I you were in Toronto at this time. So I think you remember what the industry was like. It was mostly positive only trainers. So when I would call these people, they would literally say to me, oh, well, he's never going to change. That's just the way he is. You should move out of the city. That was the advice I was getting. And so I was like, this can't be possible. Like, this can't be possible. I mean, there has to be a solution. So I kept doing research. I kept trying. And then finally I found a trainer who was using a balanced method, who started to guide me in the right direction, where I finally started to understand what he needed. And that's kind of, so helping him is ultimately, I think, what brought me to professional dog training, because without having to deal with him, I don't think I would be here.
So then would you say he is reactive at all now? Or is
he
that...
still can be. Okay. So if I don't make sure, because he's one of those dogs who's constantly trying to protect or guard spatially. So if I don't make sure that I'm watching where he's standing in space, and if I allow him to stand between me and somebody or a dog or whatever, if he doesn't like that person or dog, or if they try to get into our space, he probably will react. So I have to be very aware of what's happening all the time.
Got it.
It doesn't help that we did a DNA test and he has very high genetics of wolf penis, apparently.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which I think you've probably worked with dogs who have that.
Yeah.
It automatically puts them in a different level. He's still to this day one of the most challenging dogs I've ever worked with.
Good. That's it's good because as a trainer, I mean, imagine if he ended up anywhere else. So it's good that he did end up with you.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say, so you get Batuque and all these problems start happening and then you go see a balanced trainer.
Yeah.
Right. So what exactly did you have to do to get a handle on all of these things? How long did it take for things to get comfortable?
Well, with him, it took a long time because by the time we found this trainer, he was 3.
Oh, wow.
So I was
looking for a good trainer for how long?
for like 2 years.
I don't want to say good. I want to say a trainer that knows what they're doing.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. It was about two years. And okay. In the meantime, like trying to apply the knowledge that I already had from my other bad dog. I mean, you know, thank God for Shella. Because honestly, if I hadn't had Shella and been able to have the experience of raising a dog from scratch and being able to have a dog who's like literally bulletproof, I would have been like, what is wrong with me? Like, what am I doing wrong? Like, obviously it's me. Yeah. I mean, obviously it is all off in the handler, but like, I would have really felt like I'm incapable. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But because I had that experience of raising Shella, I knew that I was capable of raising a dog who was like that, who was bulletproof and like super social and super neutral and like could have been like a service dog if we wanted.
Yeah. So do you remember the first information you were given? Like, you know, the trainer sees Batuk and then says, okay, this is what you need to do.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the trainer that I saw has very specific instructions for his clients. And so the very first day that we went into the training studio, the instructions for that day was that he needed to sit and give me eye contact. Which was a very good piece of information for me to understand because I realized that day that he didn't look to me for direction at all. So that day when I asked him to sit, so his obedience was good. That wasn't a problem because I had that already, that training knowledge, right? Yes. So when I asked him to sit, he actually didn't, he broke the sit, I think once in the 20 minutes that I was waiting for eye contact, but he wouldn't look at me. And so that was a huge indicator of how he felt about me as his protector and as his leader, right? And so that was one of the first pieces of advice. So that was literally the only thing that we had to do between that session and the next session. That's was great. Get him to give me eye contact, which honestly...
Without asking for it.
Without asking.
Yep, good.
So like voluntary eye contact, it was a lot of work. It took a long... It didn't just take like between that session and the next session. Like it took a long time.
Got it. And then after that was done, so you said it took about 20 minutes?
So it took the very first time he sat for 20 minutes. Now, mind you, it was a distracting room with, there was a daycare on the other side of the, you know, 4-foot fence.
Yeah.
So there was a lot going on, but still 20 minutes is a long time for a dog to not look at their owner.
Yeah, that's really long.
So then after that, we came back, I think it was like 3 to 4 weeks later. Cause I had to work and it still, it wasn't perfect. And then we started working on how to correct his reactivity.
Got it. Got it. And then, so, okay, he gave you eye contact and then you guys started working on the reactivity. Mm-hmm. Now, what would you have to do there?
So there he got me on a slip leash. I was at the time on a martingale, I believe. Now I was, funny enough, against e-collars and prong collars, right? actually, before I saw that trainer, I started with an e-collar for recall because he kept running off with other dog walkers in their packs. So essentially what would happen was I'd be at Sherwood in the trail and he'd disappear. And then I get a phone call like 10 minutes later, a dog walker had my dog with their pack because he was so unattached to me. The pack of dogs is what he gravitated towards because that's what he knew, right? And so he would end up with these packs of dogs.
Oh my goodness.
So I needed to figure out recall because this dog, if you didn't let him run for an hour a day, he was going to destroy my apartment, be very, very unhappy. So we started e-collar training, which I also was kind of against before I started. But, you know, as you learn, you realize they're not those crazy, like, abusive tools that people make them out to be. But, yeah, so he put me on a slip. He taught me to do a leash correction, which did not go well. So Batuk was a redirector, and it also would break the trust that he had in me. So I could see that when I would correct him, like, it would really shut him down, and then he would also like redirect. And it was like breaking the trust that he had in me. So that's where the trainer told me to use the e-collar instead.
Got it.
So that it would be not like a direct, like, cause he had a lot of abuse on the streets, right? Like I saw what happened to dogs that lived on the streets and it was pretty obvious by his behavior. Like they just kick dogs for no reason.
Yeah. They'll just run up
for absolutely no reason.
Yeah.
And so it probably happened to him. I mean, he was on the street for at least 6 months, many, many, many times. So that kind of like, you know, to him, it's almost like I'm abusing him.
Yeah.
So it didn't work very well.
No.
But the e-collar was great. The e-collar worked well.
Good.
Yeah. And then we eventually moved to a plastic prong, I think. Yeah.
Got it. And is that Was that just your kick into dog training? Like, how would you say you get started? Do you remember your first ever session? Do you remember everything you did?
My first ever session, like ever?
Training yourself, yeah.
Oh, do I remember my first session? It was with a rescue organization that I started working with when I first opened my business.
Nice.
And I was like giving them severely discounted rates because I was new trainer. I was green. I think it was some of these really challenging dogs that come from Texas, you know, usually bully mix with hound, bully mix with heeler, very pushy, reactive, sometimes reactive with the owner. It was a few of these like difficult cases where they're very dog reactive. Some of them, even when you ask them to sit and they sit on your foot and you say off, they like come at your face because you've asked them not to sit on you.
Yeah.
Like that kind of intense. So that was actually funny because the beginning of my professional dog training career was like, now that I look back, really, really, really intense. I'm very lucky that I didn't end up getting bit because these dogs were crazy. Like, really?
Yeah, these are the Texas-Tennessee dogs, the pit mixes. Yes.
Exactly. These dogs, like, I mean, I think it's a lot of genetics that make them so nuts because a lot, like I said, they're mostly pit mixed with things that you shouldn't mix pit with.
Pit and hound.
Yeah, or heeler, right?
Yeah, heeler.
So that was my initial experience. I had so much work from that rescue organization in the first 2 years. Like, I ended up having to cut my work hours with the job that I had at the time because that's how much help they needed.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, you were mentioning earlier the industry when you started or using the prong collars. Because you know what? I can relate. I remember in Facebook was the thing back then. No one had Instagram. Instagram was just photos and filters.
Yeah.
You would post a photo on Facebook. I remember I posted a photo of a dog wearing a prong collar. I'm like, dog is walking great now. And I forget which year it was. Must have been 2011 or 12. And at this point, I'm not even 20. Like, I think
okay.
I was 19.
Oh, no.
And I post this photo, and then overnight it gets shared probably like 100 to 300 times. And everyone's like, oh, my God, this guy's a freaking horrible.
Oh, no.
Abuse methods. And I was like, and, you know, I was 19, so my mom's there. I'm living with my mom. And then I was like, hey, mom, look, all these people are, like, cussing me out online.
That's
and
terrible.
I had to show my mom. And she was like, what, for what? And I'm like, for using this prong collar on this dog.
Yeah.
That was over, just for boarding and just for walking. And the dog was, like, just a pretty bad puller.
Yeah.
And then my mom was like, well, my mom's just sometimes very common sense.
Yeah.
She's like, well, then, I don't know, can the dog walk without the prong collar? I'm like, not really. The dog is bad. And she's like, well, then why do those people care? Are they stupid or something? This is just what they said. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, that's pretty reaffirming. Yeah.
Good.
And you know what? You're right. I did take the photo down just because I was tired of seeing comments.
Oh,
I was young.
God.
But have you seen something similar in the industry? Have you seen things change or would you say a lot of things are similar to back then?
No, I think it's changed a lot, actually,
yeah.
Especially since the pandemic. So I think what happened was the pandemic, as we know, brought a huge surge of dogs into everywhere in the world. But especially Toronto. I mean, like, every single neighborhood in Toronto is packed full of dogs. I remember before the pandemic when I was training, you know, I would go to certain neighborhoods and you wouldn't really see too many dogs walking the streets, right? Now it doesn't matter where you go. They are everywhere.
Yeah.
So obviously everybody has a dog. But the thing is that because of the pandemic and the lack of socialization and the number of rescues that were brought in at that time, there's a lot of dogs that have problems. And so I feel like now, almost everyone knows someone who has a dog with a problem. That wasn't the case, I don't think, before. Like, most people who had problems, like, they wouldn't bring their dog out, so you wouldn't really see it. There's a lot of shame around it. You know, if the dog had issues, it would just be locked in a room when people came over. You know, like, it was very hidden.
Yeah.
But now I feel like it's something that people are starting to become more educated about because it's a much more common issue. And I also think that people like you guys who are like being able to offer these huge group classes and really be able to train a lot of people at one time and educate a lot of people at one time. Like I noticed in our neighborhood, and I think it might be thanks to you guys, there's a lot of tools and there's a lot of people that I see with prong collars and e-collars and like properly fitted. So we're not talking like, you know, the person who goes and it's a necklace and it's like, what are you doing? No, like properly fitted, like all the gear is correct. like you can see that they've had training with somebody.
Yes.
And so it's, you're not seeing so much backlash from people being like, oh, you're an abuser for putting that on your dog. I mean, yeah. I do hear some of my clients will tell me that this will happen in certain neighborhoods, but I'm just noticing, like, especially where I am in Midtown, there's a lot more understanding.
Yes, and we've seen a lot of people that have worked with you too, like just we'll be walking and then we'll see someone with an e-collar. And if they haven't worked with us, I always ask them. It's always hairy tails.
Is
like,
it? Okay. Yeah.
Like we'll go up through Bayview. Sometimes we walk through Mount Pleasant and I'll see like a prong on a dog. And then, you know, they actually move over and sit. Like,
oh, right. Yeah.
I'm like, where the hell did this person come from? And I'm like, hey, did you guys do training or something with your dog? And they're like, yeah, with hairy tails. Okay. So we do see it all the time. So
yeah.
I do think we've made a pretty big change in the, I don't know what area this would be, Young and Eglinton area.
Yeah, it's Young and Eglinton. Leaside, yeah.
Yeah, so great. Yeah, you are right. I especially do love when I see people with a big, bright yellow remote.
Yeah,
it's always nice to see.
Yeah.
The industry is luckily quite different. Whenever people come to see us, we make it very, very black or white. Like, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like it, guess what? There are so many other trainers. We are completely disinterested in doing things another way.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people that don't like us for it, but, I mean, at least I'm not lying.
Like, no, I'm totally.
Doing what I think is right for every dog.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I don't use tools, I use a very wide range of tools, and it really just depends on owner and dog. But obviously, ultimately, there are some dogs who will need a prong, or there are some dogs who will need an e-collar to finish and fix the issue that we're dealing with. And so when I recommend a tool, I say to people, I'm recommending this because I believe that this is what your dog needs to recover from this behavior problem. And if you choose not to use it, I'll still work with them, but I'm pretty clear that like you're going to take many, many months, maybe even years, to get rid of an issue that we could otherwise fix in a number of months.
Yeah.
So like kind of up to you. And some of the people who are like hesitant, especially with the prongs,
yeah.
They might try the slip, or will try like the figure eight slip leash or halty.
Yes,
which, as I'm sure that you know now, is more aversive than a prong collar.
Yes,
which is why I actually really don't use them very often. But I'll be like, okay, well, we can use this tool that's more aversive to your dog than a prong. Your dog's gonna hate it. Most dogs, when I put those things on, they like flip around and panic and trying to get it off their face. Like it's like obviously discomfort, right? And when they see that, they kind of go, oh, I don't like how my dog is responding. I'm like, okay, so why don't we just try a prong collar? And I usually start with plastic because I do plastic and then Herm Springer, depending again on the dog. And the plastic looks a little less scary, a little less intimidating. So it's sometimes easier to get people in that way. And then when they see how their dog responds, they're like, oh, my dog's not freaking out at all in this compared to the nose band. And that's how I end up switching them. Sometimes when I'm like a little bit more open to be like, okay, you're going to push back on this. That's fine. This is what's going to happen. But you know, it's your choice. Let's try. And then ultimately, usually pretty quickly, they come around.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Let's see. I'll just go through the other questions. Oh, this is a good question. So you had obviously very difficult first dog experience. First, second, and third. Your second dog sounded relatively
easy. My second dog was like, well, her puppyhood was annoying, but she was a very, very good dog. She was an angel dog, honestly.
Yes.
Very, very good dog.
Great. So then let's say someone calls you, and we've had this call a few times, and they say, hey, I'm looking to get a first dog.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell you, I've never had a dog before. I'm a first-time dog owner. What would you tell them? What would you tell them to do?
So often what I've actually been telling people, because I feel like this is what I might end up doing myself, I tell them you have two routes. Because some people, they want to do the rescue thing, right?
Yes.
But I'm really cautious about that because you just never know what you're getting. Like, even I feel like it's a lottery when you, even though they've been at the fosters for 3 weeks, like you don't know their personality. So usually what I say to people is like, if you want a rescue, go with a rescue organization who will do the foster to adopt thing, where you can foster and take your time and decide if you think the dog is a right fit for your family or not. Because that way you can go through a few fosters. Like I would say, don't adopt your first foster. You've got to at least do a couple. And then you kind of start to understand what you want, right? Because I think a lot of people don't really know what they ultimately need or want in a dog until they've actually had a dog in their home. Or I'll be like, okay, so now we're going to go down the puppy route. And you need to get a breed who's going to be relatively chill. So that's more difficult because today I've noticed that a lot of the retrievers are not easy anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all resource guarders.
Yes. Yeah, and they're also like really hyperactive,
really demanding,
like not how they used to be at all.
They're very
so
different.
So now it's hard because these breeds that used to be the go-to aren't really the go-to anymore. Sometimes I tell people like get a greyhound.
Yeah. Oh,
literally
the best.
Get a whippet or a greyhound or something. Cause yeah. I almost never see them.
Yeah. And when you do see them, it's mainly for, oh, the dog's nervous, but the dog's not capable of doing any harm to anybody.
Totally.
It's just a shy dog.
Yeah.
And, I think they're awesome.
Yeah.
And there are tons of them available in rescues, tons of them available from Spain.
Yeah.
Like you can get a ton. So I think they're awesome. Yeah. I would love to have one.
I actually would have had one had Batuk not have arrived in our lives.
Oh, right.
I was actually really considering adopting a greyhound before he ended up in our home.
Wow, your whole life would be different.
Like, I know, right? I probably wouldn't be a dog trainer.
I know, yeah.
Yeah. No, so I am grateful for Batuk and my first dog for being such pains in the asses because great. I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, so good. Are there any puppies you would see nowadays or any dogs you would see that you would actually say are pretty easy? Any types of dogs?
Shih Tzus.
Yeah, they are very easy.
But they're not as common anymore.
They're rare. They're all in Scarborough.
Are they? All of them got are it. In okay. Yeah, Shih Tzus are really, they're pretty chill.
Yeah.
What other puppies do I see? I mean, most puppies I see are doodles, cockapoos.
Oh, yeah, in your area, especially the doodles are.
Not ideal.
Yeah, cockapoos. Oh, man, they're everywhere. Everywhere.
Lots
everywhere.
Of resource guarders.
Yes.
That's what I see a lot for puppies, honestly. It's all the doodles.
Doodles. Would you say there... So regarding all the dogs you say, would you say there's a specific behavior you see the most? Or you deal with the most?
Well, reactivity, but that's just because I'm known for it, I think.
Yeah.
I think reactivity is also super common.
Yes. So, I think nearly if you go for a walk, every dog is in some way reactive.
Yeah.
They're either excited, they flatten to the ground, they bark at something,
totally.
They pull. I think it's funny whenever I was thinking about this yesterday, people will say, I see these dogs. Why do we see these dogs? You know, a client will say this. Why do we see these dogs walk down the street and they walk great?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the owner doesn't have any tools on them, any gear. And it's funny because I always have to say, you know, are you sure they're great? Are you sure? Because I know they're out there. I know they're the nice, easygoing dogs are out there. But if you really take a look at them, they don't give a crap about their owners. They're walking and they just haven't found something exciting yet. But if they see a dog, they're not good. They'll pull, topple over the owner. Some of them start barking and who knows how they are at home.
Yeah.
So it's funny when people ask us that, oh, why are those other great dogs out there and they don't have any tools on? Well,
they were raised properly. I mean, I have a neighbor down the street right now. He's had Bernies his whole life.
Yeah.
And he's pretty strict. He has a balanced method approach.
Good.
And he just got an 8-week-old puppy.
Nice.
And it's adorable watching him watch this dog. He's already walking the dog with the leash dragging behind him going down to Sherwood. But it's because he's raising the dog properly from the get-go.
And
he will never need a prong collar. He will never need an e-collar. Like he already knows what he should be doing, right? Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, and you don't see many of those.
No,
because even the dogs, they may seem like angels on the walks. You know, often it's not the case. It's really not the case. There's something they're doing at home. And I think we're really realizing this with daycare. People will tell us, oh, yeah, my dog's great. And then we see all sorts of, no, they're not.
There are a few dogs in my neighborhood that I'm always pleasantly surprised where I'm like,
great.
Good work.
Yeah.
You know? A lot of them have had training in the past, right?
Good. I'd say even up, what's the street? Is it Keewatin or something? The dogs are pretty nice over there. I've met a lot
of
them.
Well, the street that connects to Sherwood where I live, like that where they all go into Sherwood, that's where I see, because I live there and we go to the park. But that's where I see these dogs. Like there's a Mal that lives in that area. Again, the dog used to be on tools, not anymore. I saw her grow up as a puppy and now she's just like,
oh, great.
Off, like fine. Like totally normal for a Mal. I mean, obviously the owner needs to seriously know what they're doing, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, they do. All right. Let's see. Are there specific behaviors you like to work with? I know you probably do like working with reactivity.
I do actually.
And are there things you don't like?
Separation anxiety.
Oh, yeah. Separation anxiety is really fun right now.
Well, the reason why I don't like separation anxiety is because because I don't board and train, I have to get clients to follow protocol, right? And I find that the protocol that they need to follow for separation anxiety, a lot of people are just not capable of following the program. And so I'm actually at a point now where I'm addressing. So first I'm going to assess the dog, because some of these dogs don't actually have separation anxiety. So the owners think they do, but when they come in, it's actually a matter of the dog is losing it, because when the owner leaves, they lose control of being able to protect them. So it's a tantrum. It's not separation anxiety. It's two different things. So I have to assess it first. I do this test thing. They have to send me video footage, blah, blah, blah. Once we figure that out and we kind of change the relationship a little bit through the first session, if I discover that it's not separation anxiety, then we work on other things like relationship building and, like, you know, spatial awareness of, like, not letting the dog guard them and that kind of thing. And a lot of stuff to do with, like, how they interact with their dog in the home, because that has a huge impact on why these dogs think that they should be responsible for their owner's safety. But if the dog does have separation anxiety, I'm literally now just sending them to my friend up in Guelph.
Oh, nice.
Because she does board and train.
Yeah.
And she's one of the few trainers that will take a separation anxiety case.
Nice.
And successfully be able to handle.
Is this a company or a trainer?
Yeah, it's Tailored Canines up in Guelph.
Yeah, I've never met her, but yeah, I've heard about their facility.
She's great.
Yeah,
good. So yeah, so that, thank you, Taylor. Don't need to deal with those as much anymore, because before I felt like I needed to, because I didn't know where else to send them, but it's I just don't enjoy it. Honestly, I find it incredibly boring.
It is.
The protocol is incredibly boring.
And separation anxiety in a board and train is exhausting.
I'm sure it is.
Absolutely mentally exhausting.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
It's absolutely exhausting.
Yeah.
Like we do it all the time, but we're not fans of it. Like
no.
The dogs go under extreme stress.
Yeah. I know.
They get very, like, you know what stress colitis is, right?
Yeah.
When they have bloody diarrhea, like, it happens
That's
all the
terrible.
Time. Yeah. It happens all the time. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that someone has to do.
I know.
And good for Taylor for doing it too.
Exactly. Thank you for all of you that are dealing, because it's really not something that I enjoy.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't like separation anxiety. Well, you don't like working with it because it's just not fun. And it's boring.
It's
very
so boring.
Yeah.
So at least with reactivity or any other behavior issue, like, I find that there's always, like, got to figure out the underlying reason why the dog is doing it, right? And it's not going to be the same thing for every dog. And so that's why I find it's more interesting, because you have to go through a bunch of different things to eventually get to the root of it, right? Whereas separation anxiety is just... it's kind of the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, dog can't be alone.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And what are you seeing most of right now? You said a lot of reactivity. Have you had any
A lot difficult? Of resource guarding and a lot
oh,
of...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And resource guarding, what would you say? The owner, bones, space,
everything.
What would your protocol be then for resource guarding?
It depends on the dog.
Okay.
When a dog reaches 20 pounds and up, I'm like... you have to use an e-collar. I just don't think that it's a good idea to work with a dog who weighs more than 20 pounds and deal with resource guarding, where they could do serious damage to you if they bite you, which they probably will try to.
Yeah.
Most of these dogs have already bitten their owners before they come to me. So we know that they will and they're capable of doing it. And I also find it's the least confrontational way of dealing with that issue.
Yes.
So
yeah, I agree.
I think it's the most... fair and gentle way of dealing with that issue.
What would be your opinion right now on, let's say someone's struggling with reactivity and they have a dog, and let's even say they're trying to do things in a positive reinforcement manner. What would you say if someone is just trying to do things on their own? What should they start with? Should they do what you started doing with the eye contact with your dog?
Are you talking about the reactivity, like leash reactivity?
I'm talking about leash reactivity. And, you know, there are lots of people that will be listening to this that have no access to training.
Yes.
It's funny, when I look up the podcast statistics, we see, like, Philippines, like, a ton of people. Like,
oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm like,
amazing.
I wonder what they're doing.
I love
but,
that.
Basically, let's say someone's listening to this and they say, you know what, my dog does these things.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go out today and I'm going to work on something. But let's say they have no slip lead, no gear. They just have a front clip harness. Is there anything they should try to do?
My first thing nowadays is actually the spatial awareness thing, because all of these dogs who are being reactive they're trying to spatially guard their human, like, all of them. There isn't one. Sometimes there's dogs who are fearful and they're doing this thing where they're, like, going behind their owner, but then they're coming out in front lunging, but then they're going behind, but then they're coming out. It's like they don't want to guard them because they're terrified, a lot of these little ones. But the owner, by allowing the dog to go in front and not say anything, is essentially telling the dog, I want you to guard me. So once you start to be able to communicate in their language of being like, no, you're going to be behind me because I got you. A lot of these little dogs who are fearful like that will calm down right away. They'll be like, oh, you mean I don't have to defend myself? Amazing. And then, of course, that also would come along with saying, don't let other dogs come and greet your dog, or people, if your dog is people reactive. Like, advocate for their space, because the reason why they're reactive is probably because too many people or too many dogs have gotten into their space, and now they feel like they have to defend themselves, right? So exactly. It's kind of like we go on a bit of like a hiatus of meeting and greeting, and then watch that space. That's the first thing that I tell people to do.
If someone's having separation anxiety issues right now listening to this, which is probably, I think, a bigger portion than even the reactivity probably. For people listening to this, or maybe they don't want to admit it to themselves yet. What do you think they can also do at home to help with that behavior?
I start with the touching. So how often is your dog touching you all day? And because a lot of people work from home, some of these dogs are literally sitting on or touching their humans for like a good 6 hours of the day. And then you ask yourself why they can't handle being without you. Well,
if hands on them,
like they're addicted to you, right? And so basically like start to recognize when your dog is touching you, and don't let them touch you without you inviting them anymore. Because that way you can start to create this detox from you. Like that's the very first tiny little step. I mean, obviously then you have the protocols, right? But that's like the first little thing that I'm like, well, if they're touching you all the time, we're not going to get rid of this.
Yes.
Agreed. It's not gonna happen.
Agreed. Yeah, there's a common theme.
Yeah.
Like someone comes in, my dog has separation anxiety, and the dog is already just jumping on them, climbing on them.
Yes, exactly.
It's always the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've probably seen, and I know this question might not be the easiest to answer. Are there any breeds you find difficult right now? Let's even say in the last 2 months, have you seen any breeds that are difficult?
Yeah, these pit hound pit heeler mixes.
Got it. You're still seeing them a lot?
So not as much, because yeah. I'm not affiliated with that rescue anymore, which is kind of a good thing. but I do feel for these dogs, because like, and the owners, honestly, because a lot of these owners didn't know what they were getting themselves into. So a lot of these owners thought they were getting a lab mix, and that is not at all what they got.
Yes.
And a lot of them are first-time dog owners. So those dogs are really, really challenging, because a lot of them have a really high prey drive, a lot of frustration. The reactivity is often based in frustration, which, as you know, can be some of the worst looking and intense type of reactivity that we see. So yeah, those dogs are challenging, because you've got to be really hard on them to get to a point where they stop.
Yes. They have to, they just don't.
And a lot of the owners don't want to do that, right? Like you were saying earlier, like a lot of the owners don't want to have to do what you need to do to get them to stop.
Yeah. And that is that's always a very common theme. So I'm sure this is something you see often. Difficult dog paired with, you know, I do like the word soft owner.
Meek.
Yeah.
Soft
owner. Yeah. I usually say it because it is the truth. It's soft owner, hard dog. Soft owner, soft dog is it works.
Yes.
Hard dog, hard owner. Depends. Sometimes the owner's too hard.
Yes. But I don't see a lot of that.
That's very rare.
Yeah.
And usually when the owners are too hard, hey, you know, like I know the dog may not be the happiest, but at least the dog's not doing anything bad.
Yeah.
You know, like the dog is definitely living with someone who's too harsh, but the dog's behaviors are definitely extinguished.
Yeah.
But soft, do you see a lot of that right now?
Soft owners?
Soft owner, hard
well,
dog.
Well, I think that my branding does have a tendency to bring a lot of the soft owners.
Yes.
And you know what they say, you get the dog that you need, not the dog that you want. And so there's a lot of conversation about how you have to show up for your dog. And that even though you may not feel confident in what you're doing right now, you've got to fake it till you make it. Because your dog senses all of that insecurities that you're sensing about this whole situation. And so it takes a while to build these people's confidence. But once they're there, they're actually more confident people in life thanks to their dog, which I think agree. Is amazing.
I love when an owner that couldn't do any of this, when you see them change and like, you know what, I've had enough. I'm going to change.
Yeah.
I'm going to change my dog. And you also see them as a human being.
Totally.
Completely change.
Amazing. Yeah. I love it.
It is the best.
Yeah.
You were mentioning earlier about a course you're taking right now for human emotions and being a dog owner and them being connected.
Yeah. So this course is actually geared towards dog trainers.
Okay.
But the person, Jess from Handlers and Humans, she has been working with trainers or owners privately until now. So she's a human therapist who had a reactive dog. So she's been through all the training to get her dog to stop being reactive. And essentially what she discovered through this process is that there's a whole lot of human emotions that need to be dealt with when it comes to especially dealing with behavior problems in your dog. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of anxiety, stress. And these are all things that need to be dealt with Because if you can't show up for your dog, and if you're kind of all in your own head, you're not going to be able to help your dog through these things. And so that's why I think sometimes these soft owners that we're talking about, a lot of them are also just not super confident people, just in general. And so you're having to try to like build this person's general confidence so that they can actually be there for their dog, which is hard. And that's why this course is going to be really interesting, because it's covering a lot of how to reach people at that level, which I think is probably like the next step in dog training, honestly.
How long did you say it is?
It's a 6-week course.
6 weeks. And so far you've done a few.
One.
You've done one.
I did it yesterday was my
first. Oh, that's great. Yes. So everything's fresh.
Very fresh, but it's good. Very interesting.
Yes.
But it is interesting because actually I was speaking with Taylor at Tailored Canines about this specific thing, and she laughed because her sister is a therapist apparently. And so she told me that when she has people that she feel like are experiencing either like depression, anxiety, or whatever, she'll literally refer them to her sister. And I was like, how do you say that without sounding like an asshole? Do you know what I mean? Like and she's like, well, I just say it. And I was like, good for you. Cause I don't know. That's one of the things that, like, I do think that some of my clients literally need a therapist. Yeah. But how do you say that to them without sounding like a jerk?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is difficult because there's always the person you meet that, you know, you'll mention something, but that you can clearly see that they have a very deep emotional attachment to the dog, which is very destructive to their relationship.
Yeah.
You seem like you deal with this honestly better than I do with the clients, because I mean, people who know us, I'm just like, look, I just don't care. I'm just get over it, which is a problem of mine, you know. But the way we see it is we've seen so many other people do it. And in the group class, I think it brings so much pressure because so many dogs just start changing.
Yes.
And I think the pressure for some people does stress them out. You seem like you're very good at this. So what would you normally say? Let's say someone comes in and you seem like you're very good at softening the process for them, making them feel comfortable. What would you say to someone who's like, they get very emotional about their dog?
Yep.
What would you do?
Especially when you tell them you have to correct the dog.
Yeah.
So that's where I have to go into the whole, like, so actually in nature, you can't extinguish a behavior without some form of consequence. Yes. That is literally science. So I don't know where these scientific studies, quote unquote, are coming out about how positive only is the only way to go with dogs, because that is not what scientific studies show about nature in general. And so the idea is that, like, for example, if you have a child and they're doing something bad, what's the first thing they're going to probably do to try to get them to stop? And I'll say, well, first you're going to probably take them aside and say, hey, this is a bad idea because, and then you're going to explain to them what could happen if they continue, right? That's going to be your first step. Unfortunately, we do not have that ability to therapy talk our dogs. And so now we have to do something to interrupt the behavior so that the dog understands that, hey, stop doing that, because that's not going to work out well for you. And so when you explain it in that way, they start to kind of understand, oh, I guess it's true. Like in life, like the reason why we have police officers in our cities is because if you didn't, it would literally be chaos and people would be doing whatever they want. So there have to be rules.
We use the Purge movie as an example sometimes.
There have to be rules.
Yes.
And there have to be consequences if those rules are broken, right? Otherwise, like you just have complete chaos. And so it has to apply to all animals, and dogs are not immune to this. I don't know why some people think they are. And so if there's a bad behavior we have to get rid of, you have to use some form of consequence. Now, what is that consequence? There are many different ways, obviously, of correcting a dog for a behavior. But what I tell them is what I'm here for is to teach you how to do that in the most fair and humane way so that your dog understands what is happening and what they should be doing instead, right?
Exactly.
And then the more that the dog performs the behaviors that we want in those circumstances, the more that I will use positive reinforcement so that they understand, oh, that's what you want? Oh, I didn't even know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the reason why I also say, because a lot of these people have had positive only trainers, right? Before they come to me.
Yes.
Are you in the same boat?
I'd say most,
yes. Yeah.
And whether it would have been a puppy school or something later, yeah.
But most of these people have tried two or three different positive-only trainers before they've come to me. And so a lot of them have realized through all of this time and money that they spent on doing this, and with the reactivity, it's typically the distraction and redirect, right? So they're trying to use treats to distract the dog to not react, right? And I'm like, well, you've seen that this isn't working. I'm like, do you know why? And some of them are like, not sure. And I'm like, well, because when you distract the dog with a treat, if it actually works, the dog doesn't see the other dog coming down the street. So you're not teaching them anything. You're not teaching them, hey, when you see that dog, just chill. They don't see the dog at all. So we're not teaching them anything. It's a Band-Aid. Yeah, exactly. It's a total Band-Aid.
Yeah. And then they always tell people, do it at a distance.
Yes.
So your dog doesn't get.
So that you can make them more positively before associate.
Before their threshold. Yeah. All yeah. these things like, okay, life is over threshold.
Exactly.
Life for a dog in the city is always over. Yeah. So we need to teach them to deal with it.
Exactly.
Right? And yeah, I've always found that a little insane.
Yeah.
Yes. I was going to ask you a few more things. So like currently, what kind of stuff are you doing? I know you have a group class, mm-hmm. right? You said you're going to be starting it in fall again.
Yeah, I haven't figured out when because I have a big workshop with Larry, Joel, and Jay.
Nice. That's,
you heard about that
September one? Yeah.
In September. And then literally the following weekend is the IACP conference.
Yes. Yes.
Which I'm actually not doing the conference this year. I'm doing the LEMA certification course with Steve and Lindsay.
Nice. Steve and Lindsay of...
He's the one who did the 3 volumes of dog training books.
Oh, yes.
Who the Positive Only Trainers took his LEMA... without crediting him and using that to say why we shouldn't use tools.
Interesting.
So he is taking back his term LEMA, which is least invasive, minimally aversive, yeah. right? And explaining basically how that is not meant to say that we're not going to use tools. It's meant to be used as how you should work with dogs, which is you use the least aversive first, and you work up depending on like what's going on, right? So he has a course that he's doing a certification in for the first time, and it's 2.5 days long. So I'm only going to be able to do the first and the last day of, I think, the conference, which kind of sucks because there's some really good speakers this year.
Nice.
But I think the certification is important because it's allowing us balance trainers to take back that term, which belonged to the balance training to begin with.
Got it. Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
That conference you were going to, you said, so you have the Larry one, and then you have, when's this LEMA course?
It's literally the following weekend. So it's wow. So busy this fall. September 24, 25, 26 or something nice. Like that.
Okay, good.
So that's in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow.
I've got to go out. Yeah.
Nice.
It's usually in the US.
Okay.
Last year it was in Florida. Yeah. It's okay. worth it though, honestly. It's a really, a lot to learn from other people in our field.
Yeah. So let's even say someone were to find you. Let's even say someone has done training before and they want to work with you. I'm sure you've seen people who've done training. They already have good leash walking or whatever, mm-hmm. and they want to see you to sharpen things up.
Yeah.
How can they find you?
So you can go to my website, which is harrytailstraining.com. So it's Harry like Harry dog, tails like fairy tales, and then training.
That's a great name.
.com. I also have an Instagram handle, which is harrytailstraining.
And do you use it often?
Instagram, yeah. So yeah. I have somebody lovely who's helping me do my Instagram because I just don't have time to post. But now that she's helping me with editing and posting and stuff, it's I'm able to do the videos and then give them to her, and then she's able to post.
I noticed you also have this new video series on gear. It's good. I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, I just figured that a lot of people, they are not even aware of some of these tools. Like a lot of people, when I take out the plastic prong, they're like, "What? I didn't even know that existed." And I'm like, yeah, it's like, it's pretty awesome because it's, I would say 75% of my clients end up on a plastic because it's super effective for most of the dogs, but it's not too harsh. So like in the cases where the Herm Springer is too much, the plastic prong is perfect. Yes. So usually the Herm Springer ends up on a lot of the like really thick, strong necked bully breeds or like dogs over 60 pounds.
Got it.
Generally.
Got it.
Unless they're really into, I have 3-pound dogs on baby prongs, but those dogs are crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
But when they go on them, the owners are very surprised as to how much they calm down.
Great. So I think that's actually all the questions I have. Do you have anything for me?
I wanted to know how you got into dog training.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like I didn't have the traditional story. I didn't think my dog was hard.
Right.
I got a beagle and then I didn't get the beagle. I was going to get a beagle, and I did a lot of research. I went on every website. I searched up dogs that are good with kids, and I just searched, and I knew German Shepherd was immediately ruled out.
Yeah,
Lab was really up there, but you know, I don't know why I thought this way. I was very I thought I was too cool for a lab. Now okay. I realize labs are too cool for me.
Yeah.
And then I just really came down to Beagle because I was sure they were going to be good with kids.
Yeah.
And at the time, my I live with my mom and grandma, and they had kids, my cousins, over all the time.
Oh, I see.
It's exhausting.
Got it.
I got this Beagle. But in order to prepare, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go do some volunteer hours with Rescues, Humane Society.
Oh, nice.
Just anyone I could. I also work with this other company called Rescue Dogs Match. At the time they were just starting to import dogs, but they're also very well known. They got this dog that was labeled, I think it was called the saddest dog in the world. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah.
Title reminds me of something.
Yeah. It was a dog that was all marketing. I met the dog and nothing.
Oh, okay.
The dog was just resource guarding. So it got returned.
Oh.
And then went to another home and got returned again.
Oh.
And he had this sad look on his face just because I think he was just tired. And they took a photo of it and they made it viral. And okay. They said the saddest dog in the world because it was returned twice.
Yeah.
And but they failed to mention the resource guarding. And everyone felt bad for this dog. So I got involved with a few rescues and I started to learn. But the only reason I wanted to learn is I didn't want to be one of those kids. Because I was in Scarborough. I went to a high school where every kid got a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all returned their dog 4 months later.
Oh, no.
It was just ridiculous.
That's so sad.
Yeah, because they would bug their parents to get a dog and they would return their dog. So I was like, I just want to be that person that makes it with their dog.
Right.
And you know, it's such a crazy thing. Like you get a dog, but it's like a borrow and you think you're going to return it. So I was just working with a few dogs. I got my Beagle. I thought she was at the beginning incredibly difficult. I thought compared to the other dogs I was working with some nervous rescues. They had low energy and I thought my Beagle was hard because of her extreme stubbornness and just craziness. But after I worked with her for a while, I did lots of peer positive methods. That's all I was taught back then.
Yeah.
I figured out how to use an e-collar about a year later. So when she was one, and then I started working with some local dogs. I started working with some dogs from the Humane Society and Rescues. And then I did a bunch of seminars from there.
Cool.
And then I was very shy to call myself a trainer.
Right.
Because I was...
I think most of us are, honestly, at the beginning.
Yeah. I was 19, 20, whatever it was. And I did private sessions for free for years before I started charging.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much how I started.
You never feel like you're good enough yet.
Yeah.
To be like, I'm a professional dog trainer. Exactly. Well, once you start making money doing it, technically you're a professional dog trainer,
Exactly. Whether
that means that you're good at it or not.
Yeah. So I had a very like organic, non-traumatic dog start. It was just, I think this is what I want to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you had a lot of good background in a lot of different experiences.
Yes.
That's cool. I always wanted to volunteer at the Humane Society, but at the time there was always these like wait lists.
Yeah, for volunteers.
Like,
it was very hard for me to get in.
Yeah.
I was turning 17.
Yeah.
I was young at the time, and they were just really not interested in me.
That's so sad.
And I kept bugging them, yeah.
Because I totally would have done it, but nope, it was too long of a wait list.
Yeah, and I believe they're still that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I thought the training skill set there was so bad. Like, the information you get is just not
well, when you were there, it was a totally different CEO or whatever, I believe, because they went through a very big change.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, like, I don't know if it was about 10 years ago now. Like, very big change.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. There was, like, a complete flip.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, no, I just not been in touch since.
Yeah.
Also working with a lot of the rescues, you experience your first dog fights, all these things, all these crazy things. I'm like, oh, wow, this industry is wild. But then the biggest issue that I've always been wondering is how is it that me as a kid, I think I was very lucky, me as a young kid, how can I figure it out with these dogs? But how are doctors, lawyers, the people that I originally, when I was growing up, I thought were very intelligent, had a lot of common sense. I was like, how are they struggling with the most basic behaviors and doing the most opposite things? And then I just started to realize like dogs are such common sense creatures.
Mm-hmm.
There are things you need to do and things you don't need to do. And the more black and white you make it, which again, I think I was lucky to do this young.
Mm-hmm.
You start realizing that's what people need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really start separating a dog away from their bad behaviors.
Yeah.
And I've always found that so difficult to teach to people who are just, they just overthink every little thing that goes on with the dog.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. Could be a bit of anthropomorphizing the dog too.
Always. Yes. Yes. Human brain in a dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So yeah, that would be it. Do you have any other questions?
No, that was great.
Great. Well, thank you so much. So Christina, how can they find you again? What's your Instagram?
So Instagram is Harry Tails Training.
Okay.
So again, Harry the dog, Tails and Fairy Tales Training. And then they can email me, again, harrytailstraining@gmail.com.
Great. I just want to make sure no one bugs you. I think Instagram would be a good resource.
Instagram
is
good.
She has some great videos.
Yeah.
If you guys want to check them out.
Yeah.
Great. So that would be it for now. Thanks again, Christina. Great having you.
Thank you.
And we'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye.